And welcome to another episode of the podcast. Today, we're going to be speaking to Eric Milosevic. Eric is a retired LAPD officer. Now, LAPD does not have the best reputation as far as excessive force is concerned. But Eric is actually taking a completely different approach in the sense that he is using his voice for good. Today, we're going to be talking about compassion and love, especially in high-stress situations. And we're also going to be talking about the rehabilitation of veterans. You're not going to want to miss this one. This is The Learning Man. All right, now welcome back to The Learning Man. I am your host, Omar Cantu, and I am super, super excited to have on the show today someone I randomly met at a wedding, of all places. His story, we kind of got into a really deep conversation, and his story really kind of resonated with me, and there were a few nuggets of North Star in our conversation that I really wanted to bring him onto the show. His name is Eric Milosevic. Did I say it right? I'm terrible at bad names, so I apologize, Eric. But he has he is a retired police officer. He's a peace officer with the Santa Monica PD out in California, in LA, and moved out to Austin, Texas, a couple years back to kind of get a new lease find yourself and kind of get a new lease on things. And I'm just really stoked to have you on the show. Today we're going to be talking about compassion and love, and from a masculine standpoint. And please welcome to the show, The Learning Man. This is Eric.
Thank you, Omar. Yeah, really a pleasure to be here. It was really great meeting you the other night. It's one of those, I think, yeah, I don't know if I want to say a few times, one of those like blessed times when I met you, and just right away I felt, I don't know, I just felt like I knew you, you know, and we started chatting, and it just really flowed and felt really open and safe and talking to you.
For sure.
You told me you had the show. I was like, wow, okay. Yeah, let's do it. Let's put it out there. So thank you for having me on.
Yeah, no, thank you for making time. And, you know, kind of, you know, we had this conversation, you know, prior to getting started today. But, you know, Eric, you asked me what this is all about, and I kind of like summed it up, you know, because Eric came in, he's looking at the logo, he's like, what's up with the logo, like what's going on with this? And I kind of like explained to him that, you know, I'm personally on a journey, and I know that you mentioned that you're kind of on a journey, and part of that journey, I feel, is kind of like making yourself vulnerable, right? And kind of going out into the wilderness, into the desert, if you will, and, you know, meeting strangers, connecting with them on different levels, and trying to figure out, you know, what are those nuggets, right? Those nuggets of truth, those North Stars that you can kind of like, you know, absorb to become a better person yourself. And, you know, and I feel like that's what a lot of people do during Burning Man. And so right. This is The Learning Man. So that's the reason why.
Perfect. Yeah, it makes sense, because I saw the learning spelled like burning. So I was like, wow, what's going on there? And then, yeah, it totally makes sense. And I've been to Burning Man a couple times.
Yeah.
Which was an amazing experience that we can or don't have to talk about.
Nice.
But yeah, definitely part of the after cop journey for sure.
Nice. So let's talk about let's talk about your experience. I mean, you have 27 years of experience as a peace officer. 25 years. And out in Santa Monica. I mean, right. And you were telling me during our conversation that one of the primary things that you kind of would try to bring is that compassion, right? That level of compassion for your fellow man, and you would take that into your everyday, like,
right.
Into, you know, because you were a trainer, you would train up and coming officers, and what was that like?
It was actually beautiful. Like I never thought I'd become a police officer, you know, which I later really peace officer, which is interesting to me. Just on that, really quick on that, if you look in a lot of like the California Penal Code, it'll say peace officer throughout it. But then when you get on the streets, it's really, you know, it's just police officer, police officer. And I think that our words are so powerful. And I really think it would be best if that said peace officer on the officer's uniforms and even on their badge. I just think it feels just to resonate differently. So I saw myself as that, you know, as a peace officer. And from the get-go, I remember day one when I was at the academy and my dad came up and he pinned my badge out and my gun. Sorry, I might get emotional throughout some of this. I'll reframe, but it was an emotional, you know, it was a big moment. But I just remember looking down and thinking, wow, how did this happen? Like, I didn't even get it at the time. I kind of figured it out later, but it was like, how did I become a police officer? How did this happen? And I, in that same moment, I thought, you know what? I don't know how good I'm going to be at this job, but I know one thing. I'm going to treat people right.
Right.
I'm going to treat people good. I'm going to be cool. I'm going to be a cool police officer. And after 25 years, when I left, I looked back and I was like, you know what? Overall, I think I played that out, man. I think I was cool. I think I treated people right.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt good.
And that never really was your path, right? Like, you kind of fell into law enforcement, correct?
Yeah, you know, I later figured it out. I went to a program called Landmark Forum. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
And
I think people have a lot of different, like everything, right? People have different opinions about it. Some people say, is that a cult? And I looked up cult, and it's not a cult because there wasn't one leader we all prayed
right.
to. But it did help me out a lot in a lot of ways. And one thing is that we did a life review in the course, and you kind of look back on your life and figuring out, why did you turn this way or that way? And why did you become who you are today? And what I saw when I was a kid, I just little, my parents used to fight, nothing crazy, a lot of verbal back and forth. And and I would get in between them and try to break them up. And, you know, and my mom, like, she kind of coined me that, you know, she didn't call me a peace officer, but, you know, that I'm here to protect her. You're my little protector. I'm going to protect my mom. And I got started in the next thing I'm in martial arts, and I'm on this path of this protector from 7 years old. And I enjoyed martial arts. I enjoyed, you know, the whole Bruce Lee and all that stuff. But I really wanted to be a performer. I really like performing and all of that. But there was this path that I kept going on as this protector. So as life went on, I really pursued it for a short while that as an actor and wanted to perform and liked, even as a kid, performing, getting up and doing little circus acts in front of my friends and stilts and, you know, whatever, playing that these different characters and roles. And went to Hollywood and tried, you know, my best at it. But I liked theater. I did some theater in college, and some plays, and that seemed to flow pretty well. But then when I got into Hollywood and I was 18, and I was like, whoa, the industry got me. And it was really more than I felt like I could handle at 18. And so I just fell back. I didn't realize it at the time, but I fell back to that protector mode. And I was like, well, and I also thought I wanted to be in, like, you know, action movies.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if I can't act it, I'm going to live it. And I'm like, all right. So I started looking, and I'm like, I'm joining the military, infantry, airborne, and 82nd Airborne. And so I went and did that, jumped out of airplanes, and for 4 years did that. Was a sniper, a recon sniper. And I never went to combat, which is kind of a weird thing as a military guy. I feel like it's like you are on the football team and you sit at the bench the whole time, you know?
Right.
I mean, yeah, it's weird. I mean, obviously I don't know how well I would have treated, you know, combat. I don't know how well that would have gone down with me anyway, you know? I mean, I think I could have done what I needed to do, but I don't know how the aftermath would have played out.
Right.
I work with some veterans now from time to time, doing some breath work and listening to their stories. And, you know, God bless those guys, man. But yeah, I got out and I started teaching Taekwondo because I had done martial arts again. And even in the military, I was on the all-army Taekwondo team. And so I competed internationally and I did okay. You know, it wasn't the best, but I did okay. I had a hard time, like, fighting. I feel like I do better. When I was a kid, they called me Mad Dog. There's some Mexican dude, and that older guy coined me that because I'd go spar, and I didn't like sparring. I'd like to do the katas and, you know, the forms or whatever. I like doing that. And fighting, I didn't like it. I was scared. I didn't like to fight. But then once somebody hit me, then I was on. I was like rage. I was like a mad dog.
Yeah.
And so I felt like, yeah,
like like Waterboy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, don't get me mad that it's on. But anyway, got through that, and I was teaching Taekwondo, had a little school, and had kids coming, but most of them for the projects that I wasn't making. I was scraping by, and I thought, God, man, I guess I could be a cop, you know? And one of my martial arts instructors, his dad was a police officer, and I had a lot of respect for him, so.
Okay.
I applied, you know, and I came out number one on the initial tests, and I was, like, happy and a little surprised, and, yeah, next thing you know, I mean, I became a police officer.
Wow.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, you're training other officers, and then the next thing is 25 years later, you're retiring.
5 years later, yeah, I'm on the other side of it. And I remember when I was a police officer, there was a couple of things, like, I kind of developed, you know, myself, ways of being. And one was I always tried to have a positive connection with people. Like, I'd arrest somebody and then I would try to just win them over, you know, like, I'm flashing back. I remember one time these guys showed me a picture of this guy. They got beat up pretty bad. I mean, they arrested him, and I don't know the details, but they're, yeah, look at this guy. And he was beat up. And I said, yeah, you know, I'm not impressed by that. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to impress me, it's like you, and I've gone to situations like this where you have somebody who's on, you know, an episode, they're going off, maybe high on crack or who knows what, having this episode, sometimes naked in the street screaming and yelling. And now, can you go in there and talk that guy down? Mm-hmm. Can you talk him down, connect with him with compassion, and get in his vibe and understand, and then talk him into handcuffs and take him without having to beat him up? That's impressive to me. You know, at all levels. Ram Dass, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he tells a beautiful story. And I'll just paraphrase, but it's because it's worth it. I just love this story. Where there's a martial artist, and he had been studying Kung Fu for years, but he was still fairly new, and he never really got to try his martial arts. You know, he's a younger guy, and he gets on this subway, and he's on the subway, and some guy comes in drunk and yelling and pushing people, and he's like, oh, here's my opportunity to do this. And, you know, I'm going to use my martial arts on this guy. So he's about to get up to do something. And then suddenly this guy in the back, this older gentleman, is like, hey, yelling at this guy that's going off at everybody. You know, what are you drinking? Come talk to me. And he comes over and he starts engaging in conversation, talking about what he's drinking. He's like, oh, yeah, well, I like to drink this with my wife. And he starts engaging in conversation. He's like, why don't you sit down? And the guy sits down and talks to him. And by the end of the conversation, the guy's crying, and I guess this master's holding him in his lap. And that's what I'm talking about. Like, that's the master.
Right.
That's the master. So we're always working towards that. And I do believe that, not to get it twisted, because really the better you are, and I said, I had another great conversation one time with this Aikido master, and really the better you are at the physical, then you can go into a situation where there's some guy that's volatile. And if I'm in those situations, I'm watching their hands, I'm watching what's going on, I'm thinking physical, I'm thinking I'm going to have to trap this arm, elbow the guy, you know, take him down and do what needs to be done. I'm thinking that as I'm treating him with compassion. But because I know what I'm going to do physically, then I can do it without any fear. I don't have to go into fight or flight in those situations. So I really, it's that yin-yang thing, that practice. These martial artists, they're really the best ones. And it holds true. I mean, look, there's always exceptions to every rule, but if I've seen the best martial artists, and I've met some amazing from the, you know, the Gracies and different guys in Krav Maga, the best guys, if you meet them somewhere, they're the nicest guys. And they're really authentically just nice guys.
Yep.
You know, but they could cling, you know, the floor with you.
Yeah.
But they're so gentle and kind, you know, and it's because they don't have, there's nothing to prove. There's no bravado.
And it's usually the guys that are, you know, if I've watched, you know, learned anything from watching MMA and, you know, UFC recently, it's the guys who puff up their chests are the ones that are going to go down in 12 seconds.
Right. Know? Yeah.
So.
Yeah. They say, like, blue belts are the, you know, they're the dangerous ones. You learn just enough, they want to get out there. And,
right.
You know, get in trouble. Yeah.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that, you know, it, but I think a lot of those teachings, those are Buddhist teachings, aren't they? Like, I mean, I feel like I've heard that type of mindset coming out of, you know, monks and, those monk training, that they trained their entire lives and they could just wipe the floor with anybody, but they practice peace at all times.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, when I got out of law enforcement, I was fortunate enough to create a class called Mindful Breathing and the Art of Keeping the Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about that. I talked about, the kind of yin yang. And even if you look at one of my, my PowerPoint, one of my PowerPoints was the American Eagle. And in the American Eagle, in one talon are the arrows, but in the other talon
is the olive branch.
Is the olive branch. Yeah. And in, and the eagle's looking towards the olive branch.
Mm-hmm.
And in law enforcement, we got a lot of training on the arrows, from guns. And I taught them. I trained them. I mean, everything on your belt, I did. I mean, I got trained in the gun, of course. But I taught everything else really on the belt, from the taser. I was a taser instructor. Mm-hmm. We even had nunchucks, which was my favorite thing. And still to this day, the fact that I got to carry nunchucks as a cop, I taught things.
They do things differently in LA.
Yeah, that was Santa Monica, which I brought them to Santa Monica. I started a smaller department, Hawthorne, and we got him there. This guy named Kevin Orcutt, he's from Denver. He's a martial artist, police officer, and he basically, he was trained obviously in the martial arts, but he created this for law enforcement with nunchucks. And there are not a lot of departments, it's not real, you don't see a lot of them, but they're out there across the nation.
Wow.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
Right. Yeah. Most people don't. They're like, what? And even when I was a cop, I would be standing, say whatever, Starbucks, waiting to get my coffee, and people would be looking at me and looking at, my belt, and they're like, are those nunchucks? And I would always pull them out. And as a matter of fact, they are nunchucks. And then I would give them a little demo and show them the nunchucks.
That's
and
awesome.
Yeah. It was really good. And the main, what I really liked about them is, you could swing them. And one thing, as a kid, you're swinging them around, you're doing whatever, catching them, but not really hitting anything. It's more like a show. So you got to learn what it's like to hit something, because they recoil back. So you got to learn how to, deal with that. But really the primary use of them, I hit one guy one time with them. That was it. Every other time, and I used them, I don't know, hundreds of times, was to actually wrap around a wrist, and you grab and you've got this great control on them, and freaking hurts. It's like a vice grip, and so you have control. You can take people mm-hmm. down, or it's really good. If some officers are struggling with a guy, you go wrap it around their ankle, and you sweep their leg up, and you take them down to the ground. So most of it is actually for grabs, for control.
Wow.
Anyway. Great tool. I mean, I kind of digressed off onto that, but
yeah,
it's more than
just
nunchucks and it is. It's a thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in Santa Monica, I mean, like martial arts was heavily integrated into the police force then.
In most departments, there is the issue is they don't give you enough time to train. I mean, I was a trainer. So when you're a trainer, you get more time to train. They mm-hmm. send you to classes. I went to the Gracie, the jiu-jitsu, martial arts, so I was mm-hmm. there for a week doing nothing but jujitsu for cops with them. And anyway, so you get a lot of different training. I got the nunchuck training and on these different trainings. However, then you come back and they give you so little time with officers. So like really once a year, I'd get like 8 hours with the guys. That's it. Once a year with these guys.
Wow.
Ah. And then you might get little periodic training, like, okay, you got a half hour with them at briefing, And the guys aren't motivated. They don't want to get sweaty and whatever, but you're teaching them like, whatever you can. So they don't, the actual line, and that's really across the nation. They're not getting enough training. And so what happens is these guys, they're not getting enough training. That's what kills me when people are like, they're training them to be, what they're actually not training them enough. Because then I've seen good hearted men, good people, and they get in a situation and they go into fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go into fight or flight, now it's survival mode. So then you're striking, you're hitting, you're not thinking. Because look, as a police officer, if I'm dealing with somebody, I'm like, okay, at this point, I'm justified in using this force. I can just use these handstands. At this point, now he's struggling, he's coming to strike me. Oh, I can strike him one time, and now I have to see how this is going. But the bad guy, he doesn't play by any of those rules.
Right.
He's doing whatever, So you have to be, really present in the moment. But once you go into fight or flight, you lose that. Because now you're just in the fight. You're just an animal. So you're punching and hitting like, whoa. And it's going to be looked at later on video. And they're going to go, maybe you could have hit him that one time. But then he hit him three more times. That's not called for. And it is. You have to be that. I am not giving these guys a break, an easy out. They have to be that professional.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to ask them to be those professionals, then they got to give them the training.
So there's not enough training in my mindset, you know, and a lot of officers, well, I don't even say a lot. I would tell, so when I was a trainer, I would get, as soon as a new guy came in, I would talk to them. And one of the first things I would tell them, enroll yourself in a martial arts school. Go take some jiu-jitsu. Go take some Krav Maga. I don't really care. Go take something, you know, where you have a good instructor and it's for your own protection, but physically if you're in a fight and, you know, so you're doing the right thing on the street.
So when you, I mean, because 25 years, you know, on the forces is a pretty good stretch. I mean, what in you mentioned that when you were in as a trainer, one of the things you talked about a lot was compassion, and it was is a lot about love and trying to get these young cops. You know, you saw the negative things that were happening around you. You know, LAPD doesn't necessarily have the best, you know, reputation, especially during the period of time that you were there, which is what, the 90s, right?
Yeah.
And so you saw a lot of that. I mean, how did you kind of, what were some of the conversations that you had with these young men in terms of how to be the best cop that they could possibly be?
Yeah. One thing comes to mind is I remember this one young man who became a police officer. He was 14 when I met him, and he was at the I had like 4 years where I worked at the Police Activities League, and I worked with at-risk youth. And one of these young men ended up coming to the police department and working as a cadet. And I remember at the end of one of my shifts, he saw me and he goes, "How many people did you arrest today, sir?" And I said, "You know, the question should be, how many people did I help today?" I mean, you're going out there. And you get called, these people are at the worst moments of their lives. They're calling the police, you know, they're in dire straits.
High stress situations
and a lot of emotions. And so it's like, how are you going to, you know, connect with these people?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of going back, when I created this class, Mindful Breathing, Now to Keeping the Peace, one thing I've talked about, the arrows and then the olive branch. I said, you go, how much training do you get on the arrows? Yeah, we get quite a bit. I mean, you need more, actually. You need more, but we get more. But how much do you get an olive branch? Nothing.
Not a lot.
Yeah, really. When you go to the academy, they gave you a little bit of this verbal judo, which was actually really pretty profound, good stuff. But if that's it of the academy. It's like, there's no more. We don't have time for that. So it's like my training was a lot of that. Like how, let's talk about how we keep the peace. Let's talk about the olive branch. Let's talk about how do we calm someone down? How do we read their body language? And a lot of it is even just eye contact. I know, like, since leaving the law enforcement and some different meditation and yoga practices and different things I've gone to where they do eye gazing. Have you ever done that? It's pretty profound. Like, you'll sit in front of someone, like we're sitting here now, and, you know, we're in conversation. And if you notice, like, we'll look away and we come back.
Mm-hmm.
But you eye gazing, you just sit there for 1 minute, and it could be longer. But I mean, 1 minute, even 1 minute. And you, no conversation, you just look into each other's eyes.
I would just laugh.
That happens. That does happen.
I would just
laugh. That's pretty normal for like maybe 10 or 15 seconds.
Yeah.
And then that subsides. And then, okay, now what's under that?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not, you know, not always. Sometimes there's just this, a lot of times it's very calm. It's very like nice just to really connect with someone like that. And then often tears will come. You know, with people.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah. And you really feel this connection with someone. At least, you know, even just welling up, you can see it in their eyes, you know, and it just depends, obviously, where people are at with this feeling of this connection. And that's one thing I did with the police officers. I was like, in my class, I did eye gazing for a minute. And a minute, I mean, a lot of times, I mean, there's, you know, these couple things you go for an hour, which is insane. Mm-hmm. But like even a minute. And some of these guys would be like, oh, you know, I'm going to eye gazing for a minute with this guy. And I'm like, okay, look, you're a police officer. You're going out there and you're connecting with these people in the most dramatic times in their life. And you need to know how to connect with people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a problem sitting here and looking and connecting people, and looking into someone's eyes for a minute, then then you got an issue, man, because you got to really, how you got to like connect with people, man, and you know, where are they at? And really, the eyes to me are like the mirror to the soul, where people are, you know, and you can really see what's going on.
Did you ever have kind of like any type of situations where, you know, it was a really intense situation that you were able to diffuse it simply by talking to somebody and getting them to back down a little bit and reevaluate the situation?
Yeah, I mean, several situations. I'm trying to, like, of course, nothing's coming to mind right now, particular situations, but yeah, a lot of times that was the case, you know, in the street. That would be people that would be pumped up, and that you got to go in there and just, you know, connect with them. I remember even too, I was working kind of as a extra duty, and even a lot of times on my own time with a boys club, and there was these teenagers in, and I would go there, and they didn't have an athletic program, so we created one, and I would volunteer and go there once a week. And then I see these kids, and they're like, they got in a fight on the promenade and in Santa Monica, and I show up, and the officers are dealing with them, and they're bad-mouthing them. And then he sees me, and I see this kid. And he's like, "Hey, Officer Milo." And just like that, it switched. I'm like, "Hey, let me talk to this kid." You know, and I was able to calm down because I got to know him. I'd already established a relationship, you know, with this kid. And I ended up doing that a lot with people, the homeless people,
yeah,
to gang members, people on the street, just realizing that, you know, we're all humans going through whatever we're going through.
Well, know, and I would imagine that a lot of people, they just want to be seen, you know, yeah. A lot of people that are in kind of like those types of, you know, that may be homeless or they may be, you know, in a gang situation where they are trying, you know, they feel the pressure to be something that they're not, or in the case of, like, you know, people that are, you know, destitute, that they just want to feel that human compassion, right? They just want to feel that human connection.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's just a lot of people that don't have even that person to, like, talk to. And I feel like maybe in certain situations, they're just feeling like they need to act out another, like, to get some sort of validation that they exist. Right, yeah. That they are seen,
yeah,
and in a lot of situations that may be negative because, you know, they're trying even to get seen by, you know, the cops or someone.
Yeah, I mean, as we're talking, I remember a couple of different situations. One thing that comes to mind is, you know, I went through my own stuff, went through a divorce when I was a police officer, and different stressful times, and it was always a reminder that I would go to work and there'd be somebody, oftentimes, you know, some guy, homeless guy, you get a call, he's like lying in the gutter, and you get there and this guy's down and out in the gutter, maybe urinated on himself, defecated, passed out, drunk. And I'm like, wow, you know, by the grace of God, go I, you know, that, you know, I thought I had it rough. You know, and I feel like my own pain and struggle kind of helped me, because I'd be going through my own stuff and I'd see this guy and I'd be, "Hey, dude, you know, what's up?" And then just talk to people like human beings. And really, a lot of times it was as good for me as it was for them. I'd sit and talk to these guys about their situation. And it's a two-way street, but, like, now most cops, you have to have the camera, the video camera on. I wouldn't have done well with that, because I would sit down with some of these guys and be like, "Hey, dude, what, you know, what's going on?" And they would talk, and I'd end up talking to them about my shit. Like, yeah, dude, I'm going fucking. Because a lot of times, unfortunately, or whatever, there would be a woman involved. You get through their story, and there was like, "Oh, this happened, and my wife left me, and then I, you know, sold my house, and I'm like, and now here I am in the gutter."
Yeah.
Like, dude, I mean, no, like, my wife and this situation, and we'd sit and have, like, a conversation.
It turns into a country song.
It does. Yeah, and I'm like, rate of these people as humans. And then you're like, okay, well, you can't be hanging out here. You got to do this, you know. And
right.
I would try to get them some assistance and whatever, some direction. And
this is where you can get help.
This is where you can go. You know, and I mean, important. Look, I know our time, sometimes as officers, you get a call, the guy in the gutter, and you're just like, "Hey, get up, get out of here. You got to go. You got to move on. And that's, but it's like, wait a second. This is a human. You know, and try to make at least some connection. And I find you do get a lot more, say, with honey than vinegar, you know, in dealing with people. And at the end of the day, you feel a lot better about yourself.
Right.
Too. I remember one time there was an old woman that was in a garage. I didn't realize it was an old woman initially. It was a rainy night. I was working either graveyard, swing shift. Anyways, late at night, get a call and somebody says, "Hey, there's this homeless person with a bunch of junk and they're sleeping in our carport, this apartment." So I go there, pull up, and I see them. I could just see this pile of blankets and stuff. And for whatever reason, I wasn't in the best of moods either, you know, and I just was like, hey, come on, get up. You got to move on. And it's hard because a lot of times it's just the shell game. You're just moving people, you know, from this carport. I don't know where they're going to go. And a lot of times there's not places for them to go. Mm-hmm. And you're like, they're like, well, where am I going to go? I don't know, but you can't be here kind of thing. You know, and they got to move on. So I'm doing that. Hey, you know, come on, get up. And they start finally moving around. And then I see that it's this older woman. I mean, she was probably, you know, in her 60s. So she wasn't, but she was in bad shape, you know. And but I get her up and she has like a cart and she gets her stuff in the cart. I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry, you got to go. And she goes and she gets to the edge of the carport and the rain is just coming down. And she just stops. And then she just looks at me and I just look at her and I'm like, fuck. You know what? You're coming with me. I just say, got some of this stuff out of her car, put the cart in the back of my police car, and I drove her to the hospital. There's a 72-hour hold, it's called, and she had urinated on herself, and they said, you know, we usually 5150s or 72-hour holds, it's for people that are suicidal. That's the typical 5150. Right. They're suicidal. We're taking them on a mental evaluation. That's the typical one. Or somebody maybe is like running in the street, crazy, screaming and yelling. Okay, let's take him on a 5150, you know, mental evaluation. But it also says in there on the criteria is if someone is unable to care for themselves. And that woman totally fit this. I mean, she's urinated, defecated on herself. She's living, sleeping on the ground in a garage. Now she's going to go out of the rain. She is not able to care for herself. So I took her to the hospital and I got her into the hospital, and the staff, as soon as I walked in, they were just like looking at me because you could smell us before you could see us coming. I mean, she was rank. I mean, it was raining, and when I was driving, the windows down, like, holy smokes. So we get her into the ER. Mm-hmm. They're not happy to see us, you know, to say the least. And they're mad at me. They come out with some, like, Lysol kind of stuff. They're spraying her and spraying around and just, you know, mad-dogging me. And what is she here for? And I told them 5150s, 5150. And they were kind of going back and forth with me. But once I write it up, you know, they've got to take them. So I wrote it up. And I will say that the staff kind of, they calmed down. They started to humanize this older woman too. And they stripped her down. I was there and I'm helping them initially. They strip her down and she's just, you know, just filthy. And just sad. And they showered her. And I remember, you know, like just to watch that happening, I was like, okay, I walked away from there. Just sometimes I'd get in my car and just like, I would just kind of cry for a minute, you know?
Yeah.
And I've always been kind of an emotion. I would, you know, I would kind of keep that from the other officers or whatever. I've always just been kind of an emotional person, you know? Which was difficult at times. But I also felt it was, you know, it was healing. I just had that moment and then I was like, okay.
But that's difficult. I mean, that's difficult to hear because, I mean, that's got to be somebody's mother. You know, that's somebody's sister.
Right.
You know.
Yeah,
and there's somebody's grandmother, you know what I mean? Right. And so it's a lot of times with these, you know, homeless individuals, I mean, a lot of times, I mean, they don't have the faculties to be able to make good decisions.
Yeah.
Or they've been really negatively impacted by, you know, different relationships that they've had along the way. And so they've kind of, you know, it all kind of snowballs. And before they know it, they're in a situation like that, unfortunately.
Yeah, we're seeing more and more of it. I go to L.A. and, you know, not to badmouth L.A., but even in Venice, where I lived there before. I lived in Venice for a while and lived and worked in Santa Monica. And there was homeless problems then, and now just like a lot of the streets are just lined with this. So this is just this, I don't know. It's really bad. It's just really gotten worse, and I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I've thought of different
Seattle's
things.
Seattle's real bad. Yeah. I mean, we went on a trip a couple years ago. A couple years ago, like 5 years ago now. And when we were over there, I mean, the streets of downtown Seattle, it felt like Walking Dead, man. It was like just homeless people just kind of like wandering aimlessly, you know. I mean, we're, you know, crazy. This is a really crazy story. We're we were having breakfast in the diner downstairs from the hotel, and it's kind of like one of these diners where it wasn't the nicest hotel, but it was like one of those historical type of hotels, you know, like one of these hotels that was like back in the turn of the century. It was like really like this was the hotel that all the rich people went to, but before they went out to Alaska, like, you know, in Seattle. And so, you know, it's a pretty nice place. And we were getting breakfast one morning, and you know, just to kind of like give you the vibe, it's like this huge wooden, really hard wood and brass kind of like diner with like, you know, checkerboard floors and like, you know, just, you know, old school. Yeah. But really nice.
Cool.
And we're just having breakfast, and we're, you know, ordering and stuff. And this guy busts through the front door, and it's got like the bell, so we go ding, ding, ding. Right. And so like he walks in, and he's like Rambo, like head to toe camouflage with a black trench coat. Oh, and wow. But he comes in and he barrel rolls.
Oh,
he
no.
Like barrel rolls into the behind the podium and takes cover. And he's like, they're out to get me. They're out to get me. You know, these fucking guys they're going to fucking kill me. Everybody in here, they're going to fucking kill everybody in here. And we were just like, holy shit. Like, do we take cover? Right, like what right. is going to happen? Like what yeah. is going on? And then the lady comes over, and she, like the waitress, she comes over and she's like, not even, doesn't even flinch, like doesn't even flinch, like nothing. Right. And me and you know, the party I was with, I mean, we're kind of like, half of us were from Texas, half of us were from Florida. We were like freaking out. We didn't know how to react. We didn't know what was going on. The waitress just looks at us and goes like, he does this every other morning. It's fine. They've never caught him. And I was like, oh shit. Like, wow. Yeah. And wow. It's like,
yeah, there's some like, people that, you know, that's it living in. Who knows what that guy's history was, probably, you know, ex-military or whatever. It's tough, man. And it's a lot of like, it could be schizophrenic, you know, obviously hallucinating. There was a guy when I was an officer too, who was schizophrenic. And then a lot of times they started medicating themselves. He would do meth.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived in a garage that his mom had this apartment complex. He rented out this apartment complex, and she allowed him to live in a garage. Well, even in Santa Monica, you're not supposed to live in a garage. So you know, the neighbors were calling because he would make a bunch of noise. He would do a bunch. And then one time he actually went to the neighbors with like a hammer, and he was trying to break into their house because in his mind, there was people in there. He was trying to go rescue people, but he was on a, you know, schizophrenic episode. And what was really unique about this guy is we went into his garage one day, and he had a mini grand piano inside this garage, all kinds of stuff stacked on it. But he opened it up and he like started to play, and he was like a savant. He was amazing. I was like, I mean, actually my partner could play the piano a little bit. So before this guy played, my partner got in there and like, you know, whatever, you know,
chopsticks.
Yeah, exactly. Chopsticks. And then this guy who's, you know, he's talking to himself, and he's a little crazy. He's schizophrenic, and he gets down though and can just play. It was amazing. It was like just seeing that, wow, this guy has this talent, and talking to the mom. So anyway, that went on for months, and we tried to get him out, doing all this stuff. And then he finally one time he actually set the place on fire. They got everything out of it. They made him move. He got everything. He set it on fire. So then he gets arrested for arson. And I wasn't there that day. Got arrested, but I talked to the mom and like, oh, what are we going to do? Well, he's arrested for arson. So I actually went in and talked to the DA and the defense attorney. And I found, I was like, look, this guy, he's not an arsonist. He's got problems. He's got mental issues and he's got drug issues. And it's really hard to find a good place a facility that both works with narcotics and with schizophrenic and these abuse issues. I found a place in San Diego. It was a beautiful place. And I worked with them, and I worked with the whole court system and everything. And they actually went along with it, and they sent him there. They agreed to, and he got sent to this rehab facility.
How did he do? Say,
hey, I have no freaking idea. I don't. Well, it's not true. I know initially he was doing great. Yeah. I know when he was in the program down there, I talked to the mom. She's like, thank you. He's amazing. You wouldn't recognize him. And then, it's so interesting. And so I did hear that. And long story, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's like, who knows? He may have ended up coming right back. Chances are he ended up back, you know, the odds. It's so difficult. Yeah, what is the answer, you know? I don't know. I remember looking out at some of the island. There was an island out the military uses. There's Coronado, but there's another island out there that really nothing goes on out there. And I thought, wow, what if we built a camp out there for people? Because there's all these reoccurring people, and that you'd had, like, good food, and you had all this stuff, you know, and, like, work programs, and you'd sent them out there for, like, this long-term rehab thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. I mean, we have to think is outside the box, because we're sending, and not good. We're sending money across the world and helping people when we're at, like, internally, look at our own problems. Like, right. It's getting worse and worse. Like, how are we going to put a cap on that? Stuff. And it does come back to, you know, to, like, love and compassion. And I feel like a lot of times with the homeless, we just, I do it too. I felt myself today. Often on the freeway, I'll end up giving people a buck, a quarter, whatever, and give them a 20. And look, I know as a police officer, they're probably going to go buy their drugs or alcohol with it. I know that. But it's like, it's whatever's getting them by, you know, for that day. And I had some compassion. And I just, today there was some lady out there. She had a sign, you know, 5 kids need money. And my window was down. And I just, you know, and I hate to even say this, but I didn't look at her. I intentionally didn't look at her. And I drove off. And I drove off just kind of feeling empty. Because I feel like that's what, you know, if you look around, that's what 99.9% of us do. It's just, let's ignore it. Like, it's not happening. It's happening right in our own backyard, you know, right everywhere around
us. I'm guilty of it. I'm guilty of it. You know, like, but for me, it was, you know, I had a situation a few years back where, I would give them like a couple bucks or whatever, you know, when we would stop and stuff, until I was coming out from pumping gas, and I was about to get on the road, and this guy came up to my truck and tried to get in my truck.
Oh,
yeah. No. And so he was like, I don't know what was going on, but he tried to open the handle and was trying to get in my vehicle and stuff. I was like, what the, right. Like, what is going on here? And luckily I had my pocket knife, and I was like, with a little bitty pocket knife, I was like, you know, like,
right.
Don't you dare.
It's on. Right.
Yeah. So I was like, dude, do you want to really do this? And he was like, oh, okay, sorry, man. I thought you were somebody else. And I was like, who the hell did you think I was? Like,
yeah, push over.
You were just going to get into
Santa Claus. Just, this is my truck. Yeah.
Yeah. Just going to get into the truck. Yeah. But until then I was like, Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's tough. It's like, I don't know what the answer is. It's like, I don't know. I mean, there's some countries that they don't, you know, they really don't give handouts. And so people work and they strive and they do what they got to do to get by sometimes.
Yeah.
So you can be too soft if you're just giving them stuff. But like, how can we create programs that really help people? How can we create programs that really do transform people? Mm-hmm. One program that I've seen is, this guy, his last name is Fox. I'm drawing a blank, unfortunately. Anyway, but he's doing prison yoga. If you look at prison yoga programs, and he's changing people's lives, man. I went and hid. I did his program when I was teaching. So I was teaching, you know, mindful breathing, the art of keeping the peace to cops. And while I went on for a year, and I was, there was a grant, and I was doing teaching programs up and down California. And at the same time, I went to this guy's, I think it was like a 4 or 5 day program. If you're a yoga instructor already, you go to this program to become a yoga teacher for the prison. So I went and took his program. And what was crazy is we had some of the same slides. We had some of the same things. The main two was we had the same quotes in our presentations. And one of them was from Martin Luther King, and the other one was from Gandhi.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought, wow, that's pretty interesting. They were quoting the same people. Mm-hmm. He's teaching this to prisoners. I'm teaching this to cops. And he had a long track record of doing this. And there, you see some of the guys in some of the interviews. He interviewed some of the guys and then, you know, had it on video and just transformed their lives. So like, yeah, instead of, you know, reacting, I'm taking my time and I'm responding and choosing. And he really, he got in there, not just teaching them the asanas, the physical practice, but he really got in their minds and, you know, how do you calm yourself down? And how do you move on? So it was pretty, there are programs out there. I feel like as another system, our prison system, I feel like it's tough. It's another tough one.
It is a business. That's the sad part is it's not, you know, there's so many, unfortunately, there's so many, you know, minorities, especially, you know, there's so many black and brown men that are locked up in a system that was specifically designed to separate, you know, the financially and the, you know, the financially weak and the social class, you know, system to just keep it filled, you know? And I mean, that's evident with how, you know, I can't remember the percentage, but it's like a super high percentage of jails that are privatized.
Oh,
they're not even, you know, it's
majority for sure.
Yeah. And they get paid per head, you know, it's basically a livestock, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I don't know, again, the answer is a tough one. I have there, but there was a couple like specific incidents that will always stay with me. There was I was in Hawthorne PD, so I started out there and I got a call of a robbery, armed robbery just happened at a liquor store. And it was one of those times we just happened to be like, shit, there's a liquor store right there. We were right there, drove down the street and we see the guy, male black, big dude, like, I don't know, 6'2", 250 something. And we see him jump in a car.
Or you and your partner are like, nah, you go in.
No, you know, it's your adrenaline. You're pumped up. You know, you're like, yeah, we got him. You know, you're like, you're stoked. You know, like, boop, and we pulled up at the car and the lights and the guns and we get out. And he just, you know, yeah, thank God he, because he had a gun, but he didn't put the gun down. You know, he didn't fight with us at all. Mm-hmm. Got out, we arrested him, you know, we handcuffed him without incident, brought him into the police department, and I'm booking him, and we're in, and he was a big boy. This is where they used to have weights and stuff in the prisons, and this is before they, you know. So this dude was yoked. I mean, everyone was like, unhandcuffing him and taking his stuff, thinking, this guy, I would not want to fight with this man, you know, and putting his stuff, he's, again, being totally respectful, put his stuff in, and he just had him sit down for a second. He sits down, and he just collapses. He just starts crying. So here's where like the baddest dudes, robber, you know, gun and parolee. He'd been out, I think, less than 6 months. It's happened a long time ago, but he hadn't been out that long.
And did he rob it like for the money or for the booze?
Yeah. So I asked him. I was like, dude, what's going on? I mean, he's crying. I don't see that many, you know, prisoners like break down like that. And I just took, you know, the time just to say, hey, what's going on? He's like, he's like, man, I know. I just got out, and he had a family. He goes, I was so looking forward to seeing my family. And I get out, and with my family, and I try to get a job. And on every application, at the bottom of it, it said, have you ever been arrested for a felony?
Yeah.
And he has to put yes. And he's like, and I've talked to other guys that put no, and then it comes back to bite him. They do a research, boom, he's got a felony, you're out of here, you lied on your application. So this guy's like, I couldn't get a job anywhere. And my wife's like, what are you going to do? And he's like, I had to support my family. I just, he's like, what else, you know, what else am I going to do? So that's one thing. The system is built that way.
Once you get caught up in that system, man, you're in there.
Yeah. If you have a felony, good luck getting it off. I mean, it's nearly impossible to get it off. And I feel like there should be some way. Let's create some way that, like, I don't care what it is, but this guy has to go through some program, you know, and he's got to do a ton of, like, service and go clean the highways and, you know, whatever, do some good programs, you know, I don't know, Anthony Robbins, create a program for these guys. Okay. Maybe it's a year long program. If you go through all this and you do all this and you mark all the X, we're going to take that felony off, you know, like some way. And I also think, you know, like this is a Christian nation. They talk about forgiveness. Where's the forgiveness? Where are we, how are we forgiving that we pin them with this crime, we put them in prison, and we never forgive them. You will never be forgiven. Yeah. We will never take the, you're going to wear this, but you might as well put, you know, a star in their chest. You know, you're going to wear this forever, and you're never going to get a decent job in it. So these guys get stuck, and I've seen it time and time again.
I'm convinced it's because they are human capital, because there's money. There's money in the system.
Oh, there's tons of money in the system.
You know, privatized prisons, I mean, they're making money off these people.
Right.
You know?
It's sad. It's a sick way to make some money.
You know, and that's just the way the system's built, unfortunately.
Right.
I think it's Ava DuVernay, who's one of my favorite filmmakers. She has a really great documentary. I may still be on Netflix, but it was called, I think it's called 13. She talks about the system. She talks about how it's built to, unfortunately, like keep, you know, men of color behind bars. It's a staggering number of black men that are incarcerated just because they got you know, sucked up into the system at a very young age and just kept going.
Yep.
Getting caught
once
up.
Once you're sucked in, it's really difficult. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's people that have done it. You know, there's people that have beat the system, but it is so stacked against them. Mm-hmm. And it's so difficult to do. And you know, and I don't think the answer is what they've done a lot now in California. Well, let's just release a lot of these people. So then they just release them, but they release them without any program, anything.
Without
support.
Any training or education or anything.
So now they get out and they're like, fuck, now what do I do?
Yeah.
Now, so they're on the streets, they're trying to survive. So they end up freaking breaking in people's cars, stealing shit. So crime rate goes up. It's like, oh, you're surprised the crime rate went up? You just let all these criminals out, or these people out, without any support, any system, any training, anything. Like, what are they supposed to do? Just miraculously go work anywhere? Like, who's gonna hire?
Well, that's what prison is, right? It's school to be able to get to be a better criminal.
Yeah,
I mean, they make friends, they learn, they network, they learn, you know, different skills of, you know, the criminal underworld, and they fall back on that because they can't. They can't make a living otherwise on the street.
Right.
That's a sad part.
It's really sad. And some of these guys are very bright. I mean, you see some of those crimes and things that they do and how they figure out what to do. And then you're like, wow, if you put that energy and that intelligence into something positive and productive, you know, they would be up with everyone else and any other executive. Mm-hmm. But they're caught up in the system. And so it's tough. But I do think that it could definitely be revamped, obviously. To more programs that they're in there instead of getting trained on how to from each other and how to rob, steal, and do all like let's actually teach them a trade. And there's some of that going on, but it needs to be really, as I see it, really leaned on. And how do we do that?
But even the jobs that are in prison, I mean, they're getting pennies on the dollar.
Oh yeah,
you know what I'm saying? So it's not fair compensation. I mean, it's like, you know, they get money for their books and stuff. You know, they get to go buy a couple packs of ramen and hot Cheetos. But other than that, I mean, there's not really anything that they can, you know, it's not something they can be proud of, in other words.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of times they're not trades that can be, you know, used outside of prison, because a lot of times they can't get hired.
Right. Exactly.
You know,
that's the biggest issue.
That's what, you know. Teach them how to be entrepreneurs, you know?
Yeah.
Teach them, you know, back in the day, they used to, you know, have a boot maker. Like, you could get boots made in Texas prisons.
Yeah, there you go. That's something.
You know, then they would come out and they would open up their own shop as a cobbler, you know, or something like that, you know, but
there's trades of electricians and plumbers. I mean, these are jobs that we need people to fill these jobs, you know, and they're good jobs. So there's definitely some different trades. I don't know. I mean, and unfortunately,
it all boils down to compassion is what it, you know.
Yeah, you just write these people off and, you know, dehumanize them. I one thing, and I was really... My first chief when I went to Santa Monica was James T. Butts, and he later became the mayor of Inglewood, and he actually helped get the stadium built there. Now they're more, you know, the football stadium. But really a sharp guy, big black dude, and just very intelligent, very personable. Good dude. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. He was a good dude, James T. Butts. Here's to you, James. God, I can't even remember what the... Sorry about that. I lost it. I lost my train of thought. What did James do? I don't know.
First police, your first police chief.
He was my first chief police. Yeah, honestly, it's totally gone.
All right.
Next. It was a long night. It's been a long. It's been a long. It's been a long week. What's in this? What are we drinking? Make this
I
little.
I think it's water.
Okay. Well, that's the problem.
So I know that you were currently, you know, you said that you'd moved to Austin because you were trying to kind of like figure things out, and I know that you've kind of also been involved with plant medicine and things like that. You know, one of the, you know, going back to the, you know, the previous thing that we were talking about is like a lot of these guys, they go in for, you know, super minor drug charges and they end up getting slapped in the face with, you know, with huge sentences, you know, and unfortunately, you know, get marked, you know, a felon, you know,
right,
with the letter F on their jacket. So, what are your thoughts on, I guess, how the way the current system is built towards, you know, marijuana and, you know, drug charges and things like that. And how would you kind of, what's your mindset on that? And how would you change it in terms of, you know, given your history with plant medicine?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think things are definitely changing, you know, and these things take time. So when you're dealing with the government. But I am seeing, obviously, you know, Colorado, California legalizing marijuana and Oregon and now decriminalizing mushrooms, mm-hmm. and, you know, psilocybin, and that all the research that's going on with the plant medicines and really the proof is in the pudding. And the one thing that I'm seeing is with the plant medicine stuff is a lot of veterans are going that direction. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm a veteran. I did serve there, you know, for that 4 years. And so I've connected with a number of veterans here in Austin. On Fridays, I go out with this group of guys and go hiking. And again, I listen to some of these stories, these guys. There was another group that there's a place here in Austin called Atma, and they're working with a lot of veterans too that mm-hmm. come through. And listening to these veterans, I mean, gosh, I think it's worth sharing, and I'll just paraphrase this guy's story. But we were sitting at a dinner the first night that these guys got there. Just a small group of people. There was probably maybe eight people there, and there was these four veterans, and this one guy starts sharing this story when they were in Afghanistan and how they were on a caravan, and there's cars coming toward, barreling towards them. And there's a caravan of military vehicles on the road. And at the time, like, if here there's a caravan of military vehicles, everyone out there knows you're supposed to pull to the side and let them through. But this car is just barreling towards them, older Mercedes. Mm. And so they have protocol. So when the cars come in charging at them, they shoot to the left on the ground, still coming. They shoot to the right, still coming. So then they shoot into the grill of the car. It's still barreling towards them, gets right up towards them. They shoot into the windshield before it collides into them. And then they go up there, and they had shot and killed a 15-year-old girl that was pregnant and was in labor. And it was her family who was rushing her to the hospital.
Mm.
And the guy tells a story. You could hear a pin drop in there, you know? And then his buddy, who was also there, says, yeah, you don't forget that one.
God.
So that's what these guys are coming home with, you know. And the guy, one of the guys later, just on a, you know, like a little side conversation I was having with him, he goes, yeah, my daughter's pregnant now at home. And, you know, every time I look at her, I see that girl.
And that was in Afghanistan?
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm sharing this story. I'm obviously not giving any names, but it's just that what these guys are coming home with, you know. And I mean, let alone talking about the battles they go into where there's young men and women dying in their arms, you know, and how they got to come home and try to live with that and how to get beyond that. Another guy who's over there was, you know, the body count, just so he was getting, the job was to go out and like count the bodies and bring in the bodies of like all the dead and people. So he was just there working with dead bodies the whole time, seeing all kinds of men, women, children shot, killed, exploded. And like, then you come home, like, how do you, How do you come home?
How do you process that? And also, how do you decompress?
So what I found, and these guys talking about it, is they go in and it's all they try all the standard stuff, you know, doing this different therapies, EMDR, certain things that are, you know, they help, and they're taking, giving them a hair, or here's all the pharmaceutical meds, and they're like, none of this shit is working. And then they come and take some plant medicines. They're doing, you know, from, whether it's the psilocybin has been really successful.
Bufo
has been very successful from the, you know, the toads and ayahuasca. And there's again, the proof is in the pudding. These guys are like, wow, I feel like living again. Mm-hmm. It's given me this new vision, this new
It just basically gives them an opportunity to kind of look into themselves and essentially rewire things.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, their neuroplasticity is I guess, it makes it easier to start choosing, seeing things and choosing differently, you know, whether it's addictions or different things that are going on. And just, to, yeah, it gives them kind of a new snow. I've heard of that expression. Mm-hmm. Like, I finally, you know, they have all these trampled snow and then it's like this fresh snow. Mm-hmm. Like, I can start fresh again. And some hope. So I'm seeing that it's helped, you know, it's helping some of the veterans as well as, you know, other people, addicts. And yeah, I feel like myself just dabbled, you know, put my toe into there, the plant medicine world. So I taught Wim Hof also when I got out. I teach the breathing, the deep breathing, and that has been phenomenal, and we'll continue to do that. Breath work has helped out so much, just to, you know, and to release and to let things go. It's been really helpful for me. But then it's like, okay, well, what else? What else is going on? And I've gone through some heartbreak that has been really difficult for me. I feel like a lot of times in my life, that's been my thing. I've had a hard time in relationships, you know, holding on to relationships. Mm-hmm. I just went through a really difficult breakup. It's just heartbreak. Mm-hmm. And how do I heal from this? How do I go on? And I'm like 56 years old, man. I thought I'd have this shit figured out by now, you know?
Yeah.
And, but life, you never know, you know, the turns it's going to have.
Yeah.
So I'm actually in search too. I just sold my house out here in Bastrop, and, which I didn't know it would sell in this market. It sold, and then I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing? You know, I'm like,
where do I go?
It's sold. Yeah. And so I'm excited. I did. I went down to, and I think I told you this, I'm going down to Mexico. There's an indigenous tribe in Sonora, Mexico, where the toad is from the bufo. And I went down there and already met with them. It's a tribe of about 1200 indigenous, the Siri tribe. And, there's a first sergeant down in this guy, Mike, who got out of the military, and Bufo really helped him. And he ended up going down to Mexico with this and really embedded himself in this tribe. And they're just, it's awesome. There's like about 1200. And what's happening with a lot of these indigenous tribes is we're losing them, because the teenagers, and they get a little older, they're like, I'm out of here. They want to, you know, they leave the tribe.
Right.
So the tribe is shrinking. So it's like, what do we do to help keep this tribe going? And one of the things, that's one of the reasons they're bringing out, well, we have these medicines that are helping, that are amazing. So they're starting to like, let's share our knowledge and these medicines with the white man and really their ways, the way they are with the land, to really connect with nature and the land. So anyway, so Mike's down there and goes by Big Easy. Great dude. And another vet had told him about me, because Mike's down there and he was looking. He goes, we got like, so there's about 1,200 indigenous, and they have a force of about 30 guys that are, it's called their defense force. But it's their police. So they police the reservation, but they also protect the reservation from anything that's going on. There's 30 of these guys. And he's like, yeah, I want somebody to come and train him. So there's another, this guy, Ian, who's incredible. He was an old Black Hawk pilot, and he's so knowledgeable. He says such a huge what do you call it? Just array of people that he's connected with. So he's like, oh, he found out what I did, how I was a cop, and I trained Krav Maga, I trained cops for all these years. I was in the infantry. And so I told him that story, and he knew about Mike and that these guys needed training. And he goes, I want you to go meet Mike. So I went and met Mike, and I met the indigenous, and I met these three guys. I was in my mind, you know, I was judging. I thought they were going to be these small statured guys. These indigenous guys were big dudes. And I'm looking at him, and I'm talking to him, and I told him, the first thing I told him was, hey, look, guys, I'm old, and I'm, like, broken. I got some injuries. I'm here to teach you. I'm not here to challenge you. Don't break me. Yeah. You can break me. I'd like to tell you right now.
Yeah.
But I think I can show you some things. So I just did a quick demo and, like, some gun retention and some handcuffing stuff, and I was showing them, and they liked it. And so I'm going back, selling my house, and one of the first things I'm doing is in January, I'm going out there and hanging out with them for 5 days. Wow. I sent them a training. We're going to do, you know, yeah, handcuffing, weapon retention, defense against knife attacks. And I had no interest in doing that stuff anymore. However, it's like, okay, these guys, this indigenous team of like 30 guys that's been holding on to this piece of land for all these years. Like, so the story, as Mike tells, is the Spaniards came in there and they tried to take them out, and the indigenous just kicked their ass. So they're like, okay, it's not worth it. Just leave those guys alone. So they just left them alone. And now the Mexican government, all these, you know, that they've tried to press them out. These guys have never left their
cartels
land.
Too.
Well, I think they actually get along with the cartels.
Oh, really?
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how this story plays out. But yeah. I think the cartels don't care. The cartels are like, we don't need that land. We don't, you know, the cartels like, we don't care about those guys. Yeah. Let them do it. And actually, I think they've actually had one of their cartel guys and at least come down there and go through the Bufo ceremony. He was having all kinds of, like, imagine cartel, the stress these guys are under. You know, they're all humans, right? It's like, how do we just humanize everyone? So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know about the cartels, and from what I understand, that they don't really, that area of land is not of interest to them, and they don't really traffic through there. So I'm happy to hear that. But yeah, so I'm going down there and I'm going to train with them for 5 days and do a little movement stuff. I'm going back to infantry training too. Oh, and different infantry movements and clearing rooms with these guys. And
wow.
Yeah.
That's going to be interesting.
I don't know. I have no idea, but it feels.
And
right.
you're going to do all that in just 5 days?
Yeah, I mean, doing 5 days, I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, I'm not going to go back. I'm going to do 5 days of training, and we'll see how that, you know, how it goes from there. But from doing all these, I mean, I did 20 years. I mean, I was a cop for 25, and 20 of those years, I was a trainer.
Yeah.
So I know how to do a class, you know what I mean? So I'm structuring a class. We'll probably, like, an 8-hour day, we're going to get 6 hours of extra training in. We do breaks and lunch and blah, blah, blah. And, like, boom, here's what we're doing. Here's handcuffing, standing, kneeling, prone, blah. Here's, you know, some self-defense. We're going to be punching and kneeing and all the stuff I haven't done in a long time. And this body, I'm like, oh, jeez, how's this going to, you know? So it's going to be interesting to see how I go for 5 days.
That's
so
really cool, though.
Yeah, it should be cool. Yeah, there's going to be one range day. It's gonna be high speed for the, you know, with these guys. Yeah. You know, and here's the thing, like, I don't even know, and I got a call into Mike, said, hey, I don't even know what these guys, you know, what do they know already? Where am I starting from? I mean, these guys are warriors. They've held on to their land. They kicked ass on the Spanish. They know some shit. These guys are tough guys. I mean, there's no doubt.
Right.
You know, so it's gonna be interesting to see what I learn. This is one of those things I feel like, you know, you feel like you're gonna go teach, and then you go down there and become a student. Yeah.
That's great. That's cool.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Well, I think podcast producer is giving us the nod, so I think we're going to have to sign off here pretty soon. But where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm hidden. I'm hiding now. Yeah. I'm laying low. No, I mean, I guess on Instagram, and I got to throw this out there, is my daughter is the reason that I got this name. Like, years ago, she was like little, and she got on Instagram and didn't know what it was. Like, what's this? So I came up with a name. And in the moment, with my she was like 16,
uh-huh.
I came up with E-Rock the World. So it's E-R-O-K-D-A-W-O-R-L-D, E-Rock the World. And I actually love living into that. You know, so now I plan on traveling the world and rocking it again. So that's probably the best, you know? I mean,
starting with Sonora, Mexico.
Starting with Sonora, Mexico, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly, yeah.
Well, this has been great, man. Thank you so much for making time, and I really always have fun talking to you.
Yeah,
so likewise. This has been great, man.
Yeah, man.
Thanks for sharing those stories, and this has been great.
Yeah, and continued friendship. You know, I appreciate you, Omar. Thank you.
That's right. Thanks, bud.
And thank you so much for listening to the Learning Man podcast. My name is Omar Cantu. I could not thank you enough for joining me on this journey. If you enjoyed what you heard and would like some more of that content, we're going to be dropping new episodes every Friday. So make sure and hit that follow button wherever you listen to your podcast and write us a review, because it really does help the channel. Share what topic you want to tackle next, or maybe the name of a guest that you want to hear from. Thank you again for joining in this journey. It means so much to me.